Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast, a podcast series you can find on the web at myrecoverycast.com. In 2012, the NA Fellowship published a book entitled Living Clean, The Journey Continues. Already, this book is deeply loved by the Fellowship. It has been, or is in the process of being, translated into the many languages spoken by the NA Fellowship around the world. The book has a very interesting backstory, part of which is the subject of today's episode. We're going to share a bit of that fascinating story that has become, for the most part, a lost or forgotten piece of NA history. The project was first put on the World Literature Committee's list of potential priorities in 1983, when a member named Jet from Philadelphia, a college professor who was just then celebrating 20 years of recovery, submitted to NA World Services a completed manuscript of a book by that name. Given our highly collaborative literature development process, it was hard to know exactly what to do with the book that was offered in completed form. The manuscript was placed in the files to be used as source material when and if the Fellowship did decide to take up the project. Other major projects were prioritized and developed first over the years. It Works, How and Why, Just for Today, Sponsorship, the 6th edition basic text all hit the top of the priority list before this book did. Arguably, a project independently undertaken by some members to write a book they were calling The NA Way of Life was born of some frustration over this project not ever getting prioritized. I've always thought so anyway, though I wasn't directly involved. Finally, in 2010, the World Service Conference established a workgroup of the World Board to produce the Living Clean book, and this early manuscript was one piece of source material in the archives that was mentioned in the preface to the book. True to form for NA literature, the process for Living Clean was indeed highly collaborative. In fact, probably the most collaborative project ever undertaken by the Fellowship to date, with input received from all over the world throughout the life of the two-year project factored into the final manuscript. But Jet's manuscript was its genesis, given over to the Fellowship almost 30 years earlier. In January of 2015, months before Dave and I ever had the idea to create this podcast, he and his friend Coor from Philly sat down with Jet to interview him about his experience of writing this book all those years ago. Jet had 55 years at the time of the interview. As with so many of his generation, he had found a home in AA at some point along the way, where he continues today as an active member. He celebrated 56 years in March. We hope you enjoy his story and this blast from NA's past as much as we did. Because Dave had some direct involvement in Jet's original project in a couple of different ways, I asked him if we could start out with a short conversation between the two of us about his recollections from back then. So we start out with that.
Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Ron.
Yeah, we're doing something a little bit different than our normal format this morning. I'm going to talk to you a little bit because the interview that we have today involves something that you were directly involved in. I guess my first question to you is, you mentioned in this interview, as people will hear in a moment, that you say to Jet, do you recall the review process? And he says, yes, and then, okay, and then you go on, and you never really describe it. Can you talk a little bit about what the process was like that led to this manuscript?
Sure. Jet had, and again, to put it into a time frame, I'm thinking it was very early in 1983. It might have been a little before that, but he had told us that he was writing a manuscript dealing with recovery, and he had a number of copies made and asked a number of us to review what he had written, and then we would meet with him and take our suggestions to him. I believe my recollection is there were about five or six, maybe seven people involved in the review process, and then he scheduled at least one, possibly two meetings where he was teaching down at Drexel University, and certainly John F. was on the committee. And there were a number of other individuals, all Philadelphia area folks. And we sat and you know, we had read the chapters, and we got into a little give and take, and made recommendations to Jet about, you know, fine-tuning this, or just bringing our own experience, strength, and hope to the process.
You know, I find it interesting. This was 83, so that would mean the basic text had been written and approved, but it really was, and the red first edition was out there. People had the red one in their hands, and some people might have had the first edition blue one in their hands, but probably not. The first edition blue one kind of came out at the time of the World Service Conference in 1983. So in other words, the basic text was written, but not really known yet by the fellowship.
Right. And if you listen in the interview, I asked Jet specifically about that, and he had no recollection of having reviewed the basic text. Now, what's interesting is I read through the manuscript again today, and there is a reference to the basic text in the manuscript. So it's clear that what happened here was the manuscript was sent to the World Service Office, and some modification was brought to that. So my guess is that one of the things that was added was a reference to the basic text.
That could be, or it could be his memory is a little faded also. Sometimes,
possible.
Yeah, you know, those timelines get a little faded over time. Jet is, I believe,
84 years old, still very active. He's retired from teaching about 15 years now. I talked to him this morning, as a matter of fact, to tell him what we were doing, and he and his husband were getting ready to go off and pick fruit from an orchard here in suburban Philadelphia.
Nice.
He's very active and extremely engaged in his recovery.
So you would have been, looking back at 83, I guess you would have been 9 years clean or so?
Yes, yeah, I was. And he actually may have started that review process. I was in the DA's office from 1980 until spring of 1983. So kind of in that cusp in there is when this was going on. Because then when I got into private practices, I have a very clear recollection of getting correspondence from the World Service Office dealing with Jet surrendering the copyright and signing it over to them.
Well, let me pull a Dave on you and ask you, how did you find out about NA?
Oh, yeah, I was in Eagleville Hospital. I arrived there Friday, January 18, 1974, and I take the next day as my clean day. And it had this extraordinary series of events that led to there being Narcotics Anonymous meetings on grounds at Eagleville from 1969 on. And I got involved with a fellow who was helping to run a meeting. It was very, very small in Norristown. And he took me under his wing and took me out to NA meetings. So at the time I got clean, there were six meetings in and around the Philadelphia metropolitan area, NA meetings, which is kind of extraordinary because there were only, by my calculation, 100 to 150 meetings on earth at
yeah,
that time.
Exactly. You know, in our own show here and in some of the other stuff you hear when you hear people talking about NA history, you hear that New York history because it's so interesting. It had those two completely separate eras. And you hear, of course, Southern California, where Jimmy Kay was. You don't hear much about Pennsylvania, but in fact, there are a number of people who have 40-some years clean today. We have one in our fellowship here in Albuquerque. His name is John S. He's got 40-some years clean. He got clean in Pennsylvania way back when. So
yeah, it's kind of extraordinary. And a fellow named Roy had brought the little white book. That's it, the little white book. Picked it up at an AA convention in Northern California in 69. He claims it was handed to him by Jimmy Kay. And he brought it east, and the only place that would allow him to start a meeting was Eagleville Hospital.
All right. So I was curious. I know that you played a certain role with this book that you mentioned in the interview where you spoke to the World Service about copyright issues. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I wish I had a more specific recollection. You talk about memories fading. Mine certainly has. But I do recall getting basically the copyright release and dealing with Jet. And Jet was at the point where he was, and he talks about this in the interview, where he was simply wanted to surrender the copyright and let World do with it whatever they wished. And he felt that he was a little too attached to it and maybe trying to bring it to publication, and felt the best thing to do was simply sign over the copyright, which is what he did. And my role in that was very limited. It just, my office was used as the conduit through which the copyright was passed on.
So when you're an attorney in recovery, every once in a while you get asked to do some things like that, don't you? Like,
yeah.
You were the attorney he knew, so.
Exactly. And I had knew him very, very well. He was my then sponsor's sponsor. So we were great social friends and spent a lot of time together. So, yeah.
Did you go to law school in recovery, or were you already in that process when you got clean?
No, I was only about 2.5 years through a college degree when I got clean. And I went back at about the 2 year, 2.5 year mark. I went back and finished undergrad. And at the 3.5 year mark, I got accepted to law school.
All right. Well, one thing that we did, that you and I did after you showed me this interview and I listened to it, and we decided to make a Recovery Cast episode of it, is we sent it to somebody who was quite involved in the actual end game Living Clean book, the one that we know and love today. And we were curious as to what their reaction to the, did they look at this manuscript at all? What was their reaction to it? And they did, in fact, look at this manuscript. And I thought there was a couple of interesting things that we heard in that conversation. One is this discussion of the game. Do you remember?
Yeah, that's kind of a critical part of Jet's manuscript, and he returns to it and talks about the game as being its capacity to be a real hurdle in early recovery. It's the addictive persona engrafted onto people, places, and things, and can be a challenge for folks to move on from, to get really engaged in their own growth and establishing a new identity.
And that certainly has resonance for me in terms of looking back on what was difficult about changing. And it wasn't just stopping using. It was stopping using, and you could just fill in all kinds of blanks. And it sounded like there was a little bit of perception that had a kind of a ring about it, sort of like maybe something from Synanon or something from the way back when, the 60s-ish way of looking at addiction and recovery. I don't know. I don't know if that has any significance or not. And also that the game, if you're going to focus on the game as it relates to the illegal drug user, that some of the thinking in NA has evolved to addiction more broadly. And but, you know, even then, I would say all of us have the game. I mean,
oh, absolutely. And he talks about the game using other examples of going to the doctor's office and getting that excitement of being back in the game.
Yeah.
Going to a pornography store and getting that excitement of being back in the game. So I think he was very focused on the kinds of addictive impulses that can linger way long after the drug is gone.
That was some interesting stuff.
Let me just say this. I had forgotten about this whole project. And what's interesting, ironic really, is that the Philadelphia Convention was based around this book, as we know, and the chapters of the Living Clean were used as formats for the workshops. I actually shared at one of the workshops. I was asked was the workshop on Leap of Faith. And I never made the connection. I had simply forgotten about the original manuscript. And around just after that, I was at the dinner with Jet, and he said, they finally published Living Clean. And it just all went off. And wow. It happened very shortly before I taped that interview with him. They mention it, obviously, in the preface to the Living Clean book. And I think what they talk about the versions that were created in 1983 and 1990 contained a lot of concrete advice. I would agree with that. Suggestions. and rules for how to get clean and stay clean. I think that's going a little too far, at least on the manuscript that I read. I don't think he lays down rules so much as a little more assertive kinds of bits of advice or suggestion that we don't see in our literature so much now. But I think, again, if you go back to 1983, the fellowship is so new that you could see where this manuscript would serve a function in an area where there was not a lot of recovery, where meetings are just starting to take shape and the fellowship was starting to form. And I think he deals with very concrete issues like over-the-counter medications, sinus medications. I mean, things that people may be not inclined to think of as a threat to recovery, but there it is.
He mentioned specifically that there was a desire in this book to speak more directly to the newcomer in very concrete ways, give sort of like the Living Sober book concretely gives newcomers something that they can sort of hold on to, and basically a little bit more of a roadmap for early recovery. What's interesting to me is that the emphasis completely shifts by the time we actually do the book. And by then we had so much literature. I mean, it's so interesting that in 83, we had just the bare beginnings of literature. We didn't have Just for Today and It Works How and Why and basically a number of the pamphlets that we have now. So by the time we actually got there, now we needed something that was that would speak a little bit more to people with time.
Right. Looking for ways to engage the long timer.
Yeah. If you look at, I remember the discussion during the writing of Living Clean, is that recovery kind of unfolds along three periods. The first period being getting clean, and the second period being staying clean, and the third period being living clean. And so we felt like we had a lot of staying clean, and I think that's probably true now in the book that we got too, staying clean, transitioning to living clean, but probably with more of the emphasis on the third phase rather than the second.
Yeah.
Ben, we'll listen to the interview. So thanks for spending a little time talking about it, and thanks for what you guys did all the way back when. Such an interesting period of NA history where there was so much creativity sparking off in all directions, and this is just one more evidence of it.
Well, thank you, Ron, for having an interest in it and seeing it as historical artifact. Interest in it is certainly justified on that basis, and I think the interest in it doesn't take away one bit from the great book that we have, The Current Living Clean. It's just this original manuscript is just a very interesting part of our growth. Okay, everybody. It's January 24, 2015, 3:45 p.m. We're sitting in the home of Jet F, and with me is Core B. I'm Dave F. And what's come to pass is we're trying to find as much as we can about the history of the original draft version of the book Living Clean, which made its way out to the World Service Office of Narcotics Anonymous in 1983, and what connection it may or may not have to the book which was published in 2012 by NA World Services, NAWS, called Living Clean. So, Jet, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Okay. I just want to get a little background on you, Jet. What was your introduction to 12-step recovery?
I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in Kansas City, and I went to a AA convention at the Conrad Hilton Hotel in Chicago shortly thereafter.
What year would that have been?
Let me see. It would be about 64, I think.
Okay.
And at that AA convention, I happened to be at a meeting where some people were talking about drugs. And this piqued my interest because I had a history of abuse of drugs. And I got together with them and I asked them where they had obtained the information. And they said, well, we go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And I had never heard of the NA program before this. and I was really intrigued. And when I got back to Kansas City, I found out that there was an NA meeting, a small one in Kansas City, and I got involved in it there.
Again, this would have been 1964?
About 64, yeah.
Yeah, okay. What's your Queen date?
March 13th, 1963.
Okay. Now, do you, those individuals who told you about NA, were they from out of town?
Yes. I don't know where they were from, but okay, they were attending this convention in Chicago.
And you don't, you, and you don't recall their names?
No.
Okay. So now you find your way to the, in 1964, a Narcotics Anonymous meeting in Kansas City, mm-hmm, which, yeah, is extraordinary in and of, yeah, itself. Yeah. And what were your experiences there?
I got really active in the program. I was involved in 12-step work. There was a large Mexican population in the NA community there. And I thought these guys are just absolutely terrific, you know. And so we would make 12-step calls on people in hospitals, and there were no rehabs at this time. So if somebody was being treated for drug addiction, it was generally done in the auspices of a hospital or a mental hospital, you know, a mental ward in some hospital. And so I did a lot of that. And then I moved to Philadelphia in 1970 and threw myself into NA then, and I met you in Norristown.
Right. Now, would that have been the Sunday night meeting at the YMCA?
That was it.
Okay. Right. Now, I can tell you that from prior research, and because I was one of the people who was involved in starting that started in the spring of 1976.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's when you got to know me and the whole crowd around Norristown, correct? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did you, at that time, you got very involved in Narcotics Anonymous, did you not?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in fact, I believe you co-founded a meeting at 4th and Pine in Center City, Philadelphia, did
that's
you not?
That's correct.
And that meeting now exists, I think, at 3rd and Lombard. I can tell you that Norristown meeting was very well attended for that
it
time.
Was.
Mm-hmm. It would not be uncommon to get 30 people there, and that was a lot of people at an NA meeting at that time. Mm-hmm. All right, so now throughout this time, you stayed involved in Alcoholics Anonymous.
That's true.
Yeah, and at some point, I gather, you got the notion that NA needs some literature.
Right. I was aware of the AA publication, Living Sober.
Yes.
And I thought that NA needed an equivalent publication directed primarily towards new people. But I saw that there were a lot of deficiencies in Living Sober, both as a basic text and as something that's addressed primarily to alcoholics. And I hope that through writing a basic text like that called Living Clean, I could remedy some of those deficiencies.
And you sat down and you wrote it. Do you know what period of time was involved, your original draft?
I think it took about 6 months. And then subsequent drafts and subsequent revisions probably added another 6 to 9 months.
Okay. Now, at some point, you put together a group of people to act as sort of a panel to review your writing and to give you input on it. Did mm-hmm. you not?
I handed it out to several people, although I can't recall to whom I handed it. I think I may have given you a copy.
I was involved, yes. And I recall us meeting down in West Philadelphia on a Saturday, mm-hmm. and we had a room somewhere. It might have been, I think it was probably related to Drexel. You had gotten us a room
at
Drexel.
Yeah.
I remember us all going out to lunch. And I recall on that panel, Rich O.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I believe Herb J was involved.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And you've reminded me of Nick D. Was that his name?
Nick
last?
D. Mm-hmm.
Nick D was involved in that. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I had a copy of your draft, and it's probably still in my garage somewhere. I'm driving myself crazy trying to find it. Mm-hmm. Now, Nick D has passed on.
But he was in Delco at this time when you were reviewing.
I'm not sure.
I think he lived out that way. But he used to come to meetings in Center City, as I recall.
Yeah,
and he
yeah,
was a very
yeah.
good friend of yours.
Yeah, yeah.
And
always a sponsor. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And that's all I recall. So you do recall the review process where, you know, mm-hmm. you would seek. So, and I'm looking at a copy today, and it says preliminary third version. So obviously then there were two versions that preceded this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you know, what was it like for you? What was the experience like to sit and write this? And what sources did you pull into your process by which you wrote?
Well, there are several things I wanted to achieve. First of all, I noticed when I reread this, as I reread it just recently since talking to you, that there is a level of seriousness in this manuscript that is not present in Living Sober, the AA publication. The AA publication has these coy asides and whimsical parenthetical remarks, which are guaranteed to elicit chuckles at an AA meeting when they're read aloud, but I didn't want that vision of addiction to be present in Living Clean. And so the manuscript I wrote is one where addiction is treated with utter seriousness. And I made the comment that we know people who are blind, who once could see, people who are scarred, who once were unmarked. Addiction is a serious business. And that level of intensity, I think, prevails throughout the entire manuscript. I asked myself, well, maybe if I were to rewrite Living Clean, I could add a note of levity to it that isn't present in it. But I realized I just simply wouldn't know how to do that.
Right.
So it is what it is.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Would it be fair to say that the harsh reality of addiction being what it is doesn't strike one as fertile ground to be show levity
That's
in
right.
the publication?
That's right.
And truly life and death.
Yeah. I had been in the program long enough to see a lot of people die.
Right.
And the remarks I make about that are based on my personal history and my experience.
Right. Right. Now, at some point, did you reach out to the World Service Office to seek publication?
Yes. And I showed them the manuscript. I even went out to California and talked to the people out there. And there seemed to be a reluctance to move ahead with it. And I realized the reluctance now involved two issues. One is they feared that there were violations of the traditions in the manuscript. And also, I think the dealing with sex and relationships kind of spooked them. One of the things about Living Sober is there's no real mention of sex and relationships in that except as a parenthetical
right.
remark, you know. But we're sexual by nature, and I thought that there should be some treatment in this manuscript of sexuality and relationships.
Now, I just wanted to mention, too, that from all of the literature that I've seen, pamphlets or booklets, books, workbooks, the first time I've seen any discussion on relationships mm-hmm. was the 2012 release of Living Clean.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't touched for quite some time.
Yeah, yeah.
So you would have gone out there, do you suppose, around 82, 83?
Yes.
Madison, right? Do you know who you met with?
No, I don't recall.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a recollection of when I went into private practice in 1983, and I have a recollection of getting involved between you and the World Service Office dealing with the copyright release mm-hmm. and having some discussions with them by phone, and then they sent, I believe, to me, the copyright release, which I gave to you. Do you recall any of that?
Yes. It was pretty clear that they weren't going to move on publishing the manuscript as it was. And I realized that I was getting too emotionally involved in the whole process. And I decided that the healthiest thing for me to do was simply to sign the copyright over to them and let them do what they wanted to do
right.
with the manuscript.
Right.
Okay. So apparently it's been adopted piecemeal in
it has,
other forms of NA literature since.
Right. Well, that and also the Living Clean does roughly follow a format like mm-hmm. this. It's kind of a topical format. I'm sure I could mischaracterize it, but it seems to me that the spirit of your manuscript is passed on into this publication, although there have been many, many changes. Mm-hmm. And I think, as I've heard, one of the areas of reluctance in the world in general is to not pass on publications that are written by individuals or groups, that they follow a collaborative process mm-hmm. whereby they try to get as many groups and regions involved in the writing as they can. Mm-hmm. A little different from, I think, the way AA, because Bill Wilson Bill W. wrote most of that on his own and then put it out for review rather than try to have it actually written in a collaborative process.
And Living Sober has a single author, too.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about the fact that, that Living Clean is published, the title exists, and they, they also note, I'm not sure you're aware of this, in the preface to the 2012 publication at Roman numeral 12, the first draft of a book titled Living Clean was created in 1983. But the history of this project goes back even further. As our basic text, the Narcotics Anonymous, was being written, some of our members knew it would not be our last word on the subject of living the NA way. The versions that were created in 1983 and 1990 contained a lot of concrete advice, suggestions, and rules for how to get clean and stay clean. I don't find so much in the way of rules in, in your manuscript. I found personally a lot of very good suggestions. Now, the book basic text was not published until 1983. I have no recollection of owning a copy of the basic text before seeing your manuscript. I don't think you had a copy of the basic text.
No, I didn't.
It was not referenced at all, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I find it very interesting in your manuscript, and I haven't read it completely because this all kind of came to light within about the last 10 days that of this connection between your manuscript and the current publication. But you clearly use the word clean to describe success in the recovery process.
Yes.
And and that was a very conscious decision on your point, on your part, not to use, because some of the prevailing language at that time was either was clean and sober. Mm-hmm. You consciously chose not to use the word sober.
Yes. I think there may be one or two instances in the manuscript where I use sober, but by and large, it's a commitment to the use of the word clean.
Yeah. Uh-huh. How do you feel about it? I think it's a very interesting little turn of events in the history of NA, actually.
Yeah, I'd like to make some comments on the book itself.
Sure.
And one thing that I saw the necessity of doing is distinguishing between alcoholism and addiction to other chemical substances. Alcohol has a privileged role in our society because it's a legal intoxicant. Drugs, by and large, are not. And so what this means is that the drug user is forced to go through a certain predictable sequence of actions to obtain the drug. An alcoholic can walk into a liquor store and walk out with a bottle. But on the other hand, the drug addict is forced to interact with people in specified ways to get his drug. What this meant to me was that the whole process of obtaining the drug and the preliminary steps to obtaining the drug constitute a drama which I call the game.
I saw that, yes.
Yeah.
You talk about the game.
Yeah, this is not so significant with alcoholics because, as I say, they just simply walk into a liquor store or bar and buy a drink. What happens, I think, with the drug addict is when he first starts playing the game, it's kind of frightening. Like the first robbery he pulls to get money to buy drugs, the first fake prescription he floats to try to get drugs, it's kind of scary. But as he continues to play the game, he becomes as addicted to it as he does to the substance. And finally, the game has as great a hold on him and the thrill and the excitement of playing the game as obtaining the drug. And so I devote a chapter in that book to the game. And it has all sorts of ramifications. You know, essentially it's the NA idea of people, places, and things. And we have to reject the people, the places, the things, the music, all the other accoutrements of the game which might make using the drug desirable. And I think it plays a much greater role in drug addiction than it does in alcoholism. Although, of course, in AA, they stress people, places, and things, too. But I think it's of even more paramount importance to do that in drug addiction as opposed to alcohol addiction. Now, I stress alcohol is a drug.
Right. Sure. I did see you talking about the game. And
yeah.
What's, you know, sexuality is important. You address it very clearly. And as Cor was talking about beforehand, it may be really surely the first pronouncement of sexuality as having some impact upon one's addiction and vice versa. What was your experience with gender and sexuality in recovery?
I find it very strange that when we become sober or clean, we become asexual.
You're saying that sarcastically?
Sarcastically, yeah. I've sponsored so many people, and I've listened to so many fourth and fifth step sexual scenarios. You know, Kinsey once said that the only unnatural sex act was the one that couldn't be performed. And I agree with that thoroughly. And yet there's no mention of sexuality in the AA literature. And I think the person who wrote Living Sober is gay, but you couldn't tell it from that. I don't think there's any real discussion of gay issues in that book. And on the other hand, almost all male drug addicts, because sexuality is part of the game, have had homosexual experiences in their past, you know, as well as many other kinds of sexual experiences. And so I thought that this topic deserved airing, you know. I was at a meeting one time, and one guy was scoffing at the prevailing literature and its kind of puritanical bent and its suggestions for the newcomers, like going to museums and going to movies. And they said, you know, the guy comes in and he's hornier than a three-peckered billy goat, and they're telling him to go to a museum. And I said, yeah, of course, you know. And so at any rate, I wanted to discuss sexuality because it's part of the using game for the alcoholic and addict. And I wanted to mention gayness because it's often part of the same scheme, you know.
How do you feel NA handled that? I mean, back then when you were coming around and when you wrote this, did you feel that AA was an accepting environment?
Not originally, but I saw AA changing, just making gigantic strides in maybe 10 years.
Right.
And I came into the program in 63, and I think in 73 there were gay groups.
Right, right.
So also, yeah. Bill Wilson was very hospitable towards gays, had gay friends.
Yeah.
And I think that influenced the course of the program.
Okay.
Well, how about the topics themselves? I'm looking at the table of contents here. Anger and resentments, self-pity, diet and exercise, changes, sponsorship. How did you come up with the topics?
That's a good question. I didn't have any source that I used to get these topics, and I don't think the topics bear much of a similarity to the topics in Living Sober. Maybe some things like anger and resentments. I think one of the reasons for NA's reluctance to go through publication of this document was they felt that it was a violation of traditions, in particular mentioning other 12-step programs. That could be true. However, my point of view was that the newcomer has the right to know what resources are available in promoting his being clean. And I've seen so many people in the program succumb to work addiction. Two of my sponsees were their lives were just turned upside down through a gambling addiction that came out of nowhere. Compulsive sex is a problem for many, many people in the program. And I wanted them to be aware of other 12-step programs which deal with these particular issues. So chapter 28 is other addictions.
All right. Now, chapter 15 is methadone maintenance, which I'm looking now at the third draft that went to the World Literature Conference for approval. And that chapter is removed from that draft. But in your draft, there's a two or three page chapter on methadone maintenance. Is it fair to say that you were very careful to distinguish the difference between drug maintenance and abstinence as practiced in NA?
Yes. The experience I had seen of people coming into the program who were on methadone maintenance programs, the damaged quality of life, which they had, even though they claimed to be clean, the fact that methadone has street value. One of the criteria I use for whether a drug is addictive is, does it have street value? Suboxone has street value. You can't tell me that's not a... and I saw that being true of methadone, people getting more than their share and then secreting the amount that they don't use and then selling it on the street. And then just the entire atmosphere out of methadone dispensing facilities where people are copying and buying drugs and selling drugs. So I knew that it was simply a bad thing. And I don't recall that NA had any particular stand on that when I wrote this manuscript.
I don't recall. It certainly did not have an official stand. And it's certainly an area that still gets discussed. And you have to kind of piece together trustees' bulletins that are published by NA.org, or published on NA.org. And it's clear that NA in today, in a very gentle way, affirms the concept of abstinence while trying to walk a line that makes people who are on replacement programs feel at least welcome.
No, absolutely.
Certainly with the hope that they too will start to pursue abstinence as a goal. But you dealt with it head on. Way before anyone else did.
Yeah, anyone who wants to quit using drugs is welcome in an NA meeting.
Sure.
Yeah. Even if they're using drugs.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah. How's your life today?
I have a terrific life.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. And you, if I may, just by way of background, you were, at the time you wrote this, you were a college professor. A teacher of mathematics.
That's correct.
Yeah. But you had also done some writing. You wrote poetry, I believe.
I've published four books of poetry.
Yeah. You've published books of poetry. You've involved in editing and reviewing mathematical treatises and that sort of thing. And recovery is still very much a part of your life, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sponsoring people is... and. Activity in the program, like working with inner group and things like this, are just major parts of my life.
Yeah. And, okay. Good, Corey. All right, Jet, thank you so much. And thank you for your service, because what you did, you put a lot of effort, a lot of thought into this, and a lot of love. And I think it comes through in that manuscript.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
I'm glad to see it getting some recognition.
Yeah, me too. One of the most important things I did was just to turn the whole thing over.
Yeah.
It's being possessive and resentful of the fact that it was just as it is. It's character defect, you know?
Yeah.
The other possibility could have been not turning it over and then approaching a publisher and publishing it. And you were more interested in getting that message out to the newcomer. Through Narcotics Anonymous.
That's right.
Well, I think, and I would say that even though the chapters are different and there are many differences in the book that Jet submitted and what ultimately was published, I just think the spirit is there. And I think there's a core of what you wrote is in that book.
Good.
There are topics here, just when I look at the table of contents, that weren't discussed. This was very progressive.
It was. It really was. Yeah. Decades ahead of its time. Well, thank you. I think it's a fascinating story of an incredible document that I would be proud to show any newcomer coming in as a kind of how-to in recovery. Let's go eat.
Thank you.